KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Washington State has joined a multi-state consumer protection lawsuit. According to the state attorney general's office, the case revolves around deceptive vacation condo timeshares. And we went right to the source. Attorney General Bob Ferguson is in our studios this morning. It's great to have you here.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me this morning.
You are one facet of like 20, more than two dozen states, I believe, 27 states. What exactly is the overall suit and what is Washington's portion of it?
You bet. So right now at the federal level and with state attorneys general, like myself, there's a sweep essentially going on across the country to really try and crack down on these timeshare scams that we see more and more frequently. And we had one case in particular in Washington State. We brought that action yesterday in Thurston County against two individuals and their shell companies that involves many millions of dollars, very complex organization. So we highlight that as part of this national sweep that's going on.
So essentially, this couple who I believe live near Olympia someplace were trying to get people to sell them their timeshares, or they were buying parts of timeshares?
Essentially, it's a very complex scheme, but at a very high level, what happened was folks wanted to get out of their timeshares, right? And what these folks did was they asked for money up front, which is always the first sign of a scam, right? Asked for amount of money up front and promised to transfer their timeshare. But all they did was create shell companies and straw buyers. And so in the end, folks were left holding the bag and out the initial money that they put out there as well. So it was a very sophisticated scam, yes.
So sort of like those Nigerians that hit you up for money, except
But these folks were very sophisticated. They had folks working for them. They had a very complex organization set in place that was one that was able to deceive about 1,500 people in Washington State alone.
Now, why is this part of a national effort?
Because we've seen more and more in our press conference yesterday, we had an individual from the federal side of things there as well. We've seen an increase in these types of scams across the country as well. So on occasion, we work with our partners around other states and with the federal government to really tackle an emerging issue that we see. And this timeshare scam is one that we've seen. And because of its complexity, we decided this was one that we really want to focus and bring to the attention of consumers all around our state.
So what, practically speaking, for folks who haven't yet done this, what should we be looking for if we get a come on to know whether it's a scam or not?
You bet. So there's a couple of things that are really universally applicable, and this one's a good example of that. But one is if someone's asking you for a certain amount of money up front with a promise of some greater reward down the line, be extremely cautious. Do not give them that money. And it may seem intuitive, but in this case, 1,500 folks, folks who had timeshares, right? These are not unsophisticated people, fell victim to this. But that's a sure sign. If you have any questions at all, call the Office of the Attorney General. In fact, we found out about this scam because people contacted our office, and that's how we're able to do our work. Our attorneys and staff in the Consumer Protection Division get many of our cases from individuals who contact our office. So if you see something that seems suspicious, please do call or write to us, and we can follow up.
Will the folks who got bilked get any money back?
And that is our hope. We always want to strive for restitution directly to the individuals who are harmed. These cases are large. They're complex. They cost us a lot of money. But we're asking not just for those payments, but also for our costs in bringing this case. It's been multi-year. It's been a lot of resources, but one that we feel because of the sophistication of this effort and the large number of consumers who were scammed, it's an important one to bring.
We're talking with Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. And if you have a question about scams or any other kind of legal question, this is the man who represents the state at the top, representing our laws. Our phone number, 1-800-289-5869, or you can email us weekday@kuow.org. Talking on a national scale right now, the past week or so, we've had revelation after revelation about these various secret surveillances of today's big news, the internet, before that, Verizon. And it got us to wondering in the newsroom where Washington state privacy laws intersect with federal laws. If we have, if we are tougher on some issues, for example, DNA collection or any kind of data collection, that we could supersede the federal efforts.
it'd be difficult to sort of generally characterize Washington state law relative to federal law on those wide range of issues. I think it's fair to say that on many sort of constitutional issues, states can have greater protections than the federal government, as you and your listeners know. And I think it's fair to say at a very high level that Washington state, it's unusual for us to have greater protections for individual liberties in our state than at the federal level. That's not unusual. The overall issue of, hey, protecting one's personal data, for example, is one that we're keenly aware of in the Office of Attorney General. We frequently bring cases to protect data, for example. In fact, the case we just were talking about, I should mention the folks who we bring action against, dumped all sorts of personal information in a dumpster behind their business when they realized they're under investigation. That all sorts of personal information of individuals, that's part of our action, is hold them accountable for not handling that information in a correct way. So it's a big part of what we do is try and protect individuals' data and privacy as well.
You know, when we're talking about personal privacy, it's one thing we hear a lot about. Password and you know, checking the strength of your password and changing passwords frequently. But revelations like this one, which are at the highest level of our government, leave you feeling as an individual citizen a little bit powerless.
Well, and I understand that. And I think it's part of our job in the Office of Attorney General is to empower individuals. So, and we bring cases. I'll give you an example. We brought a case, you know, you hear about Google Street View, where Google has that map feature where you can go online. Well, as they had their cars going down the streets with devices, they were picking up information from individuals' homes as they went. AGs around the country brought a lawsuit against them for that. That information has now been destroyed. But that's an example where the attorneys general around the country can really make a difference and help empower folks to feel like, hey, they're not, that there's nothing they can do about this issue, which I understand. You pick up the paper and it can seem overwhelming, but in part, that's what we're here to try and address those concerns as well.
Another place where Washington law intersects and not necessarily very well with federal law is our marijuana legalization. And I know that we recently, a month or so ago, had the first draft of growing and distribution regulations. And it was a very, as far as I know, not even an official draft. It was like a draft of a draft. But how are you working with those drafters and with the federal government to make sure that whatever we come up with actually doesn't get challenged from the federal level?
It's a really good question, and I'll try and give a short answer. Happy to take a follow-up to it. So as your listeners know, Washington State's initiative legalizing marijuana is in direct conflict with federal law, which does not allow for the legalization of marijuana. There are two things at a high level that our office is doing. Number one, giving legal advice to our agencies and clients around the state, including the Liquor Control Board, which is the entity that's creating all those rules and regulations. So part of our job is providing legal advice to our clients so they can do their job to create the system in Washington State for legalizing marijuana. The other part of our job is working with the federal government to try and avoid a lawsuit from the federal government in which they try and prevent Washington State from legalizing marijuana. That's a complex undertaking. I met directly with U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, along with Governor Inslee, to talk about ways we can avoid a lawsuit. But that's one thing we are preparing for, what I call a worst-case scenario.
Well, how do you avoid a lawsuit when what we're doing is against federal law? I mean, it's legal in the state, but not in the nation.
Not easily. And Colorado also legalized marijuana, as you know. And so one point of having that face-to-face conversation with Eric Holder was to make sure that he really understands what our regulatory framework is, that we have a very robust regulatory framework around legalizing marijuana, to make sure we're answering their questions about how we're going forward, and also to make sure that they understand that we will defend the will of the voters here in Washington State. And we believe we have a solid argument if the federal government chooses to try and contest the legalization effort here in Washington State. So I made it clear we want to avoid a lawsuit, but we're prepared to defend the will of the voters.
Is there any indication that the federal government will challenge what Washington State is doing?
It's impossible to know. You know, we had a long conversation with Eric Holder, and he was very careful in that conversation to reveal absolutely nothing about what their intentions are. And I don't begrudge them that. They're taking a lot of time. I think they're being thoughtful about it. And I appreciate that. The federal government, I think, is trying to make a thoughtful decision. So we expect a decision anytime, and we just have to wait and see.
What is your role in relation to, for example, the city of Seattle, which is right now, I believe, going through zoning issues of, you know, where do you put these growing centers and how are they located? And, you know, it's such it's brave new world, I suppose, in the area of legalities, since it was illegal, you know, 6 months ago. Do city attorney's office contact you, your office, to make sure that everything is in sync?
Well, different jurisdictions have different authorities, right? So it could get complex in a hurry. So, of course, there are conversations between local governments and state government on some of these issues, but local jurisdictions maintain their own jurisdiction over some of these issues as well. Again, at a high level for us, our focus on giving advice to our clients, our boards, commissions, mm-hmm. universities that are grappling with this, law enforcement, as well as dealing with the federal government as well.
It seems like it'd be a new area for you, too. I mean, if something was illegal, all of a sudden it is legal. We're talking about recreational mm-hmm. use. We're not talking about selling necessarily, or selling outside the Liquor Control Board's sanctioned sales network. So
yes.
In a sense, you're crafting laws that could be challenged just because they're brand new.
Absolutely right. And I mean, it's a fascinating area. Speaking as a lawyer, it really is a fascinating area. And the national interest, for what it's worth, is huge. You know, I spoke on a panel at the Brookings Institute back in D.C. The national interest in what's going on in Colorado and Washington is really high.
Attorney General Bob Ferguson is with us. Our phone number, 1-800-289-5869. I'm going to ask you to put your headphones on, and we'll take – wait, I have to actually find my little panel. Nothing like live radio where you don't have your button. Okay. Hi, Peter in Woodinville. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Thanks for holding. That. Well, the little box was in the middle of the table, but now you're here.
Okay. I don't know whether this is in your purview, but this concerns telephone do not call lists, of which I am on as many as I can possibly be, and I'm still getting calls from an outfit called Credit Card Services that call up probably every couple of days, and it's a different person, and they say, you know, we can improve your credit, and I've tried calling them back, I've tried accepting their call and then asking them to take me off their list, and they just hang up. I've asked them where they're located, and they just hang up. And then the other day I got a call from Microsoft Security Services, and he swore that he was from Microsoft and had an ID number and everything. And finally I just hung up on him. But how do they get past this do not call? Or is there a way to stop them getting past this do not call list?
Great question. And so we see this with other attorneys general around the country as well, trying to avoid this. And so what I really would encourage you to do is what I mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is simply email our office. You can go online to our website, and there'll be a place there where you can say, hey, here, this is the organization, this is the information I know, and we're often able to have our own contact with entities, which tends to address the problem. As you might imagine, if they hear from the Attorney General's office, that can that raise the profile of the issue. So don't hesitate to call our office or email our office with the information you just provided me, and we're more than happy to take a look at and see what we can do to be helpful with that, because that can be very, very frustrating.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We are talking with Attorney General Bob Ferguson. We're going to continue our conversation in just a minute. Our phone number, 206-543-KUOW.
It's 9:20, 57 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy, expecting clouds all day, maybe a little rain this afternoon, and a high today of 71.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. You can count on KUOW and NPR to provide intelligent reporting that makes you a more knowledgeable person. KUOW's programs take you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper understanding of important issues. Now is the best time to renew your annual KUOW membership or to make a special gift. Please mail your gift in today or give online at KUOW.org. Thank you.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:21. The latest biotech news in 15 minutes.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Attorney General Bob Ferguson, Washington State's highest lawyer, is in our studios, and we're asking him questions, and you can, too, at 206-543-KUOW. Attorney General, in late March, a federal judge ordered Washington State to renovate or remove about 1,000 just under 1,000 culverts around the state. And that ruling resulted from a lawsuit by a number of Native American tribes in the state who believe the culverts have destroyed Native fish runs. You appealed that judge's ruling. I wanted to know why.
You bet. And this is a big case with huge implications for our state, running into the billions, the billions of dollars. And of course, as a lawyer for our clients, our job is to provide legal advice to our clients, but do what our clients want us to do on making decisions on when to appeal cases or often even bring cases. So I want to make sure we have that caveat. But that said, culverts are a huge issue for preserving our fish and our salmon runs. And I think in Washington State, we don't have any issues with repairing the culverts that have been damaged and that impede fish passage. But the trial court decision was, in our view, quite broad. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that rather than having one judge decide an issue of huge policy considerations for the state running into the billions of dollars, that we felt is appropriate to appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the federal court, to get a panel of judges to review, hey, what's the right role of the federal government, for example, in helping to preserve these fish passages as well. So I want to be clear, the state wants to move forward on cleaning up these culverts, repairing them, mm-hmm. preserving our fish runs. But I want to make sure it's not a one single judge determining a very large policy issue running into the billions of dollars.
$20 billion was the last figure that I saw as an estimate. That judge sort of divided the culverts. There were ones that were on recreational lands, and I'm not sure if those are state and federal recreational lands or just a number of jurisdictions. And then the deadline for fixing those was 2016, and then there was quite a long period of time to fix the rest. Are you asking the Ninth Circuit to determine which the priority of fixing them, who pays for them, or responsibility for payments?
Well, it may be some combination. I want to be clear. We have not filed our briefs yet to the Ninth Circuit. We simply filed our notice of appeal. So I don't want to get out ahead of what our appeal may look like and the specific arguments that we're making, because we haven't done that this time. But I think it's important to note that, hey, this goes back to treaties that we have with the tribes back in the 1850s and the Bolt decision from the 1970s that obviously changed the landscape in many respects, I think appropriately, to make sure that tribes have access to fish that they've had historically. And this is an outgrowth of that. One thing I'll just say is that when it comes to Native American law and the treaties, these issues are extraordinarily complex from a legal perspective, as you might imagine. And this case is one that we expect to be in the courts for some time to come.
These culverts are throughout the state. Mm-hmm. This 980, I believe, is how many culverts there are. They're everywhere. It's not just here in the Puget Sound region.
That's correct. In fact, across the country, there are vast numbers of these culverts. And it's fair to say that, yes, in many respects, we want to make sure that when culverts are constructed or after they've been in place for some time, that they're operating in a way that allows those fish to run. That's critical. I'm a fourth-generation Washingtonian. That's important to me. A big reason why my wife and our kids and my family live here is because we love the outdoors and want to preserve that. But this case does have enormous implications for our state.
You mentioned the state hadn't filed briefs yet. Do you have any sense of the timeline?
So it'll be before the Ninth Circuit, and there's a case schedule that we put together on when the briefs are out there. One thing I'll just mention is often when it comes to any matter before federal courts, it can be a long process. But this was an example of a case that really goes back to that Bolt decision in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So it's not unusual to have cases like this regarding fishing rights in the tribes in our federal courts. It's a significant part of our practice, actually.
Attorney General Bob Ferguson is with us. Rico writes in, since recreational marijuana users can have 1 ounce of marijuana and medical marijuana users can have 24 ounces, will medical users be in danger of having their legal limits changed?
I think it's fair to say that on the marijuana issue that I want to be real careful in how I respond to these questions, but the Liquor Control Board is working through the rules and regulations. We want to make sure that we preserve a system that makes sure that those folks who are using marijuana either medically or within the legal restrictions of legalizing marijuana can do that in a way without any interference from the state or in particular from the federal government. So that's something we're working on very carefully to make sure that we're handling in an appropriate way. And those are some of the legal issues that we're handling, yes.
When will we mentioned that it was a draft of a draft that was released mm-hmm. last month. When do you imagine the real draft will come out, and then how long from that draft's released to actual implementation of regulations?
It's I believe that the latest schedule on this is that we will have the regulations, the system in place this year. Okay, so at a high level, the plan is to have that in place this year, which again puts additional importance on what the federal government may or may not do or what they may or may not signal. We're in the month of June already. Things are moving quickly, and it'd be great to hear some feedback from the federal government on what their thoughts are on this, as we're well on along the road to implementation, of course.
So you're just waiting, as you mentioned
earlier.
That's
correct, yes.
For the federal government. Bob Ferguson is our guest, and we go to Monroe. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hello. So my question is this. I am a HughesNet satellite internet customer, and since it crosses state lines, is it something the state attorney general would handle, or is it something that the federal attorney general would have to look into?
So, Steve, I guess I'm not sure I can give you that answer over the phone with that information, but we'd be more than happy if you want to contact our office to give you an answer, particularly if you can provide some additional details of what you're looking at and what the issue might be. That's something we can take a look at and see if it's appropriate for our office to get involved in.
All right. I appreciate that. I'll do the email.
So. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Mark on Mercer Island wants to know if you really want every KUOW listener to call the office regarding credit card services. Nearly everyone I know receives calls from con artists, and the calls aren't traceable.
And so that makes it difficult. But if you have any information about where those calls are coming from or who they are, yes, in all honesty, we do want folks to call. It's many of the cases that we bring, I really want to emphasize this, many of the cases that we bring are directly because individuals in our state contact our office. And we see especially a large number around a certain corporation, for example, or individuals that leads our investigators to those folks. That's how that timeshare case happened. We literally had folks call us. We started having questions, did our investigation. That led to the lawsuit that we filed yesterday. So, hey, we do the best we can. We all have limited resources, but absolutely it makes a big difference for us to get that information.
Okay, Mark, you and all your friends on Mercer Island need to contact the State Attorney General's office. Jesse joins us from Queen Anne High.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hello. Hello.
You're on the air, Jesse.
Hi. Did you get my question?
No.
Okay. My question is, what's going to happen when Washington State does not implement those rules and laws about marijuana on time in, 7 months from now?
So thanks for the call. As someone who grew up on Queen Anne Hill, it's always great to hear from someone from Queen Anne. So to answer your question directly, Jesse, the plan for the Liquor Control Board is to establish and create those rules on time. They've laid out a schedule, and it's my understanding that they intend to keep that schedule, and it's important to keep that schedule as well to move forward on upholding the will of the voters as expressed through the initiative process. Our role, again, is as lawyers advising the Liquor Control Board, and it's to be, I think it's worth mentioning, they have a difficult assignment. It's an ambitious regulatory system, and in contrast to Colorado, where their initiative did not really create a regulatory framework anywhere near as robust as Washington State, so it's a real challenge for them to do that work.
So, Jesse, just be patient. It will happen. Attorney General, King 5 TV has reported that the state may take legal action against the Department of Energy if the DOE does not deliver an acceptable plan to fix the leaking nuclear waste storage tanks at Hanford. Obviously, the state wants them fixed. The governor went over there. But what is the state specifically asking from the DOE?
Well, a couple things on this. So Hanford, of course, has been an issue that has been a real challenge for our state for many, many years. And the cleanup of Hanford, which is a nuclear waste site, as your listeners know, that is one of the most contaminated, if not the most contaminated, in all of North America. So a huge challenge. It had a chance to tour it not too long ago. And as Attorney General, my job is to make sure that the federal government lives up to its obligations under agreements that they've agreed to in the Eastern District of Washington. These are agreements they've filed with the court, deadlines to clean up. It's fair to say they've not been terribly successful in meeting those deadlines. That'd be an understatement. So I take my job very seriously of doing whatever we can, using the law to force the federal government to honor its obligations.
How long are you going to give them to act before you actually step forward with legal action?
Well, it's premature for me to say what our next step will be specifically. But what I can tell you is we have a legal team in place that we talk about this all the time and analyze what our next steps are. We work closely with the Department of Ecology and with Governor Inslee as well to make sure we're taking a thoughtful approach on this, but one that I would describe as aggressive. Because one advantage we have in the Office of Attorney General is we can use the law to force the federal government to act. And Attorney General Gregoire, Attorney General McKenna, there's been a long line of AGs mm-hmm. who have really tried to hold the federal government's feet to the fire on this issue. It's not an easy assignment. The federal government's often saying, hey, we don't have the budget to do this now in light of sequestration. But my perspective is the budget excuse is no excuse not to move forward on the cleanup on time.
Well, cleanup is one thing, but the revelations of the leaking tanks, it seems like that adds an extra edge of urgency, or maybe that's just because I live in Washington State. Mm-hmm. Maybe from the federal government, that's no different. I don't know.
Well, you're exactly right. In fact, a concern we've had is that the information about these leaking tanks did not come to the state for many, many months after the federal government had that information. I can assure you we've expressed our extreme displeasure with that. We are looking at whether those facts change our legal posture with the federal government in any way. But it's fair to say that there are ongoing conversations with the federal government to make sure we don't have that problem moving forward where we don't get the information because, for the reason you mentioned, we're the ones who are affected by what goes on at Hanford, not bureaucrats back in Washington, D.C.
Bob Ferguson is with us for a few more minutes, and I wanted to touch back on a case that is not in the headlines at this particular moment, but was, which is the suit that your office filed against the Richland florist who declined to serve two men who were getting married legally under the state's new law. And I understand that she is filing or has filed a countersuit against the state.
That's correct. And so that's very common in a case like this. And so what's happened is, and one thing your listeners should know is that before filing the lawsuit, we did what we often do with small businesses, and that is we sent her a letter saying, hey, you're in violation of state law. Please agree to no longer refuse to sell flowers to a gay couple who are getting married. If she'd agreed to that, no cost, no fees, no press, no nothing. She declined to go that route, which is her right. That's how we ended up in court. And we believe that under Washington state law, under our consumer protection law, that it's very clear that you can't violate someone's civil rights, the law against discrimination in our state, in a consumer setting. And that's what she's doing. We believe we're right on the law. It'll work its way through the courts, we have no doubt. But I'm confident what the final outcome will be in this case.
Do you perceive this not just as an individual countersuit, but an attempt to try to bring the law down?
Well, it's hard to interpret that. As you may know, there were legislators, a group of, I think, 11 or 12 Republican legislators who have actually introduced legislation seeking to change our law against discrimination and seeking to remove sexual orientation from protected classes that the legislature adopted, I believe, in 2006. So in other words, our law against discrimination protects you on the base of religion, for example, or race, but also sexual orientation. There's literally a proposal in the legislature to remove sexual orientation from that protected class that resulted from this lawsuit, which I believe is obviously, from a policy standpoint, entirely misguided. But what I'm focused on is the law, and my job as Attorney General is to enforce our laws. I believe the law is clear on this, that you can't discriminate against someone on the basis of sexual orientation when you're engaged in the marketplace, when you run a business. And I take that law very seriously and intend to pursue it.
We have time for another question. And David Baker, Mayor of Kenmore?
Yes.
Thanks for joining us.
Certainly. Mr. Attorney General, just a quick question on unsolicited faxes. I understand there is legislation currently on the state books that does allow one to sue in small claims court the people who send out these junk faxes. Is that true?
I'm not aware of that, Mayor, but I believe that you must have your facts right, but I'm not aware of that specifically, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for that call. So is that something that he or somebody from the city of Kenmore could contact your office about?
Absolutely right. I know Mayor Baker well from my days on the King County Council. Kenmore's used to be in my District 1 that I represented, so I know the mayor very well, and I'll probably be calling him on his cell phone when I walk out of the studio here in a few minutes.
So aside from yesterday's lawsuit against the couple from Olympia, what's your next priority in your job?
So in general, with the job right now is, as I like to say, our job in many respects on the consumer protection side, where we focus this conversation, is holding powerful interests accountable who don't play by the rules. That's Wall Street banks, right, and other powerful interests. And we have a big focus on that. We can't get into ongoing investigations that we have, but it's fair to say that's something we take serious in our office, is to make sure that for individuals in our state who can't afford to hire their own high-priced attorney to represent them when a Wall Street interest doesn't play by the rules, that's what we're there for in the office, Attorney General. Our staff and attorneys work hard every day to make sure that we're holding those folks accountable when they don't play by the rules.
Bob Ferguson is Washington State Attorney General. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
We'll see what's happening in the world of biotech in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for the 2013 Seattle International Film Festival, now through June 9th. In its 39th year, SIFF is the largest film festival in the United States, showcasing 447 films from 85 countries this year. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
-57 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy, and the forecast says it's probably going to stay mostly cloudy all day with a little chance of rain this afternoon. Today's predicted high is 71.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield, connecting members to people and resources that matter to their health. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in Washington and is an independent licensee of the BCBSA.
9:36. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Sounds from the zoo in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. And on Fridays, we've been setting aside time to check in on science stories making headlines. Today, we welcome back to our studios Luke Timmerman. He's the national biotech editor for Xconomy based in Seattle. And you went off to Chicago since we last talked to you for the big annual cancer research and development meeting. And you were speculating, Luke, before you left, that immunotherapies and new research were going to be in the spotlight. And were you right?
Yeah. First off, I was not actually in Chicago. But
okay,
I monitored. I covered it from here in Seattle and followed the social media, which was pretty amazing this year. But yes, immunotherapy really was the big story. It didn't disappoint. We really saw some pretty remarkable results from still early studies. That caveat does need to be in there. But companies like Bristol Myers and Merck and Genentech rolled out results of early studies, maybe 50 to 100 patients, very sick patients who had gotten 4 or 5 rounds of prior treatment with melanoma, very dangerous skin cancer that had spread. And when they got enrolled in these trials, they just got the usual, like, they'd start with small doses and work their way up to see if the drug was toxic in a couple of different variations, maybe once every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks. These are not the kind of studies where you typically expect to see a whole lot of tumor shrinkage or remissions.
Oh.
And that's what they did see.
Wow.
And they were long-lasting remissions, too. So that's why people are very excited and thinking about much bigger trials that will be required to get these things approved by the FDA.
So you mentioned melanoma. Are they? I know Dendrion here has worked on what we called last time we spoke the sort of version 1.0 of immunotherapy. So that was prostate cancer. Are there any other major cancers that people are looking at immunotherapies for?
Yes. So melanoma had the most promising data at this year's meeting. Lung cancer is another area. This is the most common form of cancer in the United States. And there are a couple of others that are on the drawing board. That's part of the excitement, too, is that we're seeing this effect across multiple kinds of tumors.
So these are preliminary tests. How long, in general, would it take to get from the point that they're at to the point that consumers might be able to have these drugs if they've got these diseases?
It's hard to say, but these companies have a lot of resources and they are concentrating them on the what they call phase 3 clinical trials, which is the third and final phase needed for FDA approval. So these are very big, rigorous studies. I would say 3 to 4 years from now, we can expect to see some of these on the market.
Because once they get the results that they need for the FDA, that's a lengthy process in and of itself.
Well, it traditionally has been, but the FDA has shown a new willingness to move quickly on what they call breakthrough therapies, and a couple of these have gotten that designation. It may only be a couple of months of regulatory review once the trials are done.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I hope they're safe.
Well, that's what we'll need to verify in phase 3.
We're talking with Luke Timmerman of Xconomy. We're talking about, you know, the big new brave new world of immunotherapy, but there's a Seattle-based startup that's actually working on an antibiotic that could be great news for a lot of people who are not, you know, in the lofty world of cancer treatment. This is just like down and dirty.
Yeah. So it's a local company here started by an entrepreneur named Bruce Montgomery, who's had success at a couple previous companies taking intravenous generic antibiotics and turning them into inhalable forms for the bacteria that are hiding out in the lungs. So if you've got cystic fibrosis or you know some that's a disease where you got bacteria that cause really bad infections in the lungs, and the intravenous antibiotics couldn't really get in high concentrations deep in there, so the inhalable made sense. And he's got another idea now.
Well, this other idea is something that, first of all, his company is called Cardius Pharma, and they're raising money, and they're looking at something that people get in the hospital. And this is something you hear about a lot, which is pneumonias related to, you know, being on a ventilator in a hospital.
That's right. Bruce's thought was that if you could take a couple of these generic antibiotics that are intravenous and get the particle size and shape just right so that they can travel through a breathing tube without getting clogged up on the way and that they could travel deep into the lungs in high concentrations, you could be more effective at killing those bugs that get there.
How many people are getting this ventilator-related pneumonia every year?
A shocking number of people in the U.S. Estimates are over 250,000 people a year. And when this happens, it creates complications and expense, typically adds a couple of extra days in the intensive care unit. And as we all know, those are expensive places to spend time.
I've also heard of elderly patients, you know, you might break a hip, you end up in the hospital, you contract some kind of pneumonia, and you die of the pneumonia. That's not uncommon. So is this for the specific ventilator-related pneumonia, or maybe that was a ventilator kind of related disease as well?
Yeah. Well, it goes by a couple different names. They talk about hospital-acquired infections, which is a slightly broader term. It includes ventilator-associated pneumonias. But that's really what we're talking about.
It would seem that hospitals would be eager for something like this.
Very much so. In years past, there may have been some degree of denial about, you know, that happens to other hospitals and not us. But I think with the Affordable Care Act in place now, they are staring at the very real possibility of facing penalties for every time a patient suffers a bad outcome like this, and it's clearly the hospital's fault. So they're now more motivated to look into drugs like this.
Well, I think if you were a patient, you'd want to know that that kind of drug existed as well, just for peace of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And a drug that is targeted to the lungs and is more potent isn't going to circulate through the whole bloodstream and potentially cause some other bad side effects.
So Bruce Montgomery's managed to raise a bunch of money to really explore this possibility.
Yes, he has. Recently, $34 million to plow ahead into the next phase of clinical trials.
Well, that's fascinating. And another local related story that fascinated me was the new way that we're thinking about cell phone technology, smartphones, and ultrasound. I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, oh, you we're going to look at your hip. Let me hold my, you know, Windows phone up there and see what you've got. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, so portable ultrasound is not a new idea. That's been around for a long time. A company here in Seattle, Sonosite, had a lot of success blazing that trail. But what another company has come along here called Mobisante, and they're looking to build on commodity hardware, those smartphones and tablets that we all have, and figure out, can you hook one of those up to an ultrasound transducer and display the image that you see inside the body? Can you display a decent enough image on one of these little pieces of these gizmos so that a doctor can make an actual diagnosis? And so far, they've had some success. They've won FDA approval for this.
Well, so that we're not talking about home ultrasound diagnosis. We're talking about maybe a cheaper way to do this in your office, a doctor's office.
Right. This is not for home use.
Let me look at my knee here.
maybe somebody's thinking about that. But no, this is they're selling these at a price point below about $10,000, which is about half as much as the other portable ultrasounds. So it makes it a little more accessible for doctors who may have a slightly tangential interest in ultrasound, people in sports medicine, say, or you know, people who need it for things like guiding catheters properly in everyday use.
Well, they're also Mobisante, this new, relatively, it's a pretty new company.
Yes.
They're also talking about how they incorporate this with all the cloud computing.
Yeah, and that might be the most interesting thing that they're doing, because the earlier generations of ultrasound were very good at capturing the images and keeping them on their proprietary hardware, but not so good. They were developed in sort of the era before cloud computing and massive sharing. So if a doctor took an image and wanted to consult with a peer down the hall or a peer in some other city, that was very difficult.
Right.
But Mobisante's idea is we can capture a basic image, automatically upload it to the cloud because the smartphone tablet is already equipped with that capability. Mm-hmm. If you could do that, then a physician who's a little unsure of what he just saw can very easily share that file with a peer who's more of an expert in interpreting ultrasound images. It's a fascinating step forward.
And the National Security Association agency can see it as well. I mean, privacy jumps to my mind immediately when I hear things like that. Maybe that's the Luddite in me. I can see the benefits of it, but it also, in the era of HIPAA and all these concerns about our personal information being disseminated, the idea that you know, somebody's taking an image of your baby or your hip joint and putting it up there, it could go anywhere.
Given the headlines we've seen the last couple of days, I would hope that the company and legislators are thinking about that very question.
I'm sure they are. Last, we deviate from healthcare and go back to something that I haven't heard talked about a whole lot recently, which is how to convert algae, of which there is a lot in our region, into a fuel that could power cars or other things in our lives.
Yeah, so algae for biofuel was, it's an idea that's been around a long time. And a couple of years ago, there was a boomlet, I guess you could say, of companies that were aspiring to do this in renewable fuels. And mostly it went bust. Right. The technical challenges are just immense. But here locally, a company that sort of has been trying to get some traction the last couple of years finally did. They struck a partnership with a major oil company. They're not saying who.
Okay.
But so you have to be a little wary there. But it was enough of a commitment that one of the top faculty at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center decided to dive in full time into the startup, which rarely happens. And he's got enough resources to hire about 20 bright scientific minds to work on this algae engineering challenge for the next 3 to 4 years.
What's this company called?
Matrix Genetics.
You know, it's interesting. So we were talking biofuel, smartphone technology for ultrasounds, Bruce Montgomery talking about new ways of shooting antibiotics into people's lungs. This biotech sector, or just the tech sector in general, just seems like it's diversifying in Seattle daily. We heard about Tableau's big IPO and how much money they raised. So we're seeing at least that sector of the economy as other things sort of fade away or get outsourced to different states. Here in our region, this is not only healthy, but it is thriving and growing.
I think that's right. I think if there's a common thread there, it might be that these are people seeking to tackle some of society's biggest problems. They've got clever ideas. Some of them will work and some won't. But it's an amazing endeavor.
So when you have names like Jim Roberts, who's now gone to Matrix, or Bruce Montgomery at Cardius, when you have names that kind of have the cachet of, you know, what went behind them, does it make it easier to raise the big bucks that you need to at least explore the solutions to some of these questions?
Yes and no. Bruce Montgomery's got a great track record, but even he found it difficult to raise money a couple of years ago during the recession when this company was just getting started. He raised this latest round of $34 million after he had some preliminary data from a small clinical trial mm-hmm. that said, yes, in fact, he can deliver this antibiotic. He had some proof. So I'd say that the funding for these sort of adventurous ideas is still hard to come by, definitely helps when you have a proven track record.
Seattle's made biotech and the development of South Lake Union a priority in terms of, you know, routing roads through there, providing services, really concentrating on keeping the tech sector in the city, which leads me to wonder, where does our biotech hub rate on a national level with other places that are attracting scientists like these?
That's a tough question. Seattle has had some struggles in the biotech community, in the for-profit side. A lot of the very best companies have gotten acquired, and that sort of curtailed their exponential growth curve. But we do have a tremendous basic research enterprise here and a lot of very interesting small companies, some of which I mentioned. I'd say Boston and San Francisco are clearly in a class by themselves at the top tier. San Diego is probably next down, and Seattle is in about a third tier with, say, the Washington, D.C. area, Research Triangle Park, and some of those cities. It's a very good place to be. A lot of regions around the world would love to be in Seattle's position, but of course there are a lot of people here locally that think, we can do even better.
Hey, we want to be number one. Luke Timmerman is the National Biotech Editor for Xconomy. Great to have you in again.
Great to be here. Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Bernard, do you know that sound? I know that sound.
What is it, Marcy?
Those are the siamangs at the Woodland Park Zoo. Our listener, Adam, sent us that recording. It's two swinging, singing siamangs, he says. It was recorded by residents of the Chateau Pacific Retirement Community. And siamangs are endangered primates from Malaysia and Sumatra. And there's those little black monkey-looking things that swing around, and they are loud.
Sounds like they're having fun.
Well, they look like they're having fun, or else they're yelling at the people looking at them. It's hard to say. Love the siamangs. Well, this has been our week of animals, I must say. But you might be hearing something that is non-alive. Maybe you're listening to, I don't know, the sound of the wind.
Machines.
Machines. We'd love to know what you're listening to. Record 30 seconds of the sound and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. We hope to be able to play it on the air. Well, since we are talking about air, it's only right that we turn to Washington State climatologist Nick Bond, and you can tell us what's in the air for weather.
Right. Good morning, Marcy.
Good morning, Nick.
Yeah, today a little cooler than the last few days in which we hit 80 both days at SeaTac Airport. And the winds are from the south rather than the north over the last couple of days and bringing in a kind of marine influence. There's been a few sprinkles around, but not really much rain in the Seattle area to speak of. And so we're looking for something like around the high 60s or 70 today. More of the same for the weekend, maybe a little warmer on Saturday and Sunday, and enough clouds in the sky to give it some interest.
For you.
Yeah, there you go. And on Monday, pretty decent also, but definitely a downturn by late Monday or Tuesday, and some showers at times during the middle of the week, and cooler temperatures, maybe mid-60s or something. Our lawns need watering anyway, right?
Is this more seasonal than 80 degrees?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, our average high temperatures this time of year are about 70. And so 80 is definitely up there. And it's been a few Junes since we've hit 80 at the airport. So that's definitely warmer than normal.
Well, that's our end of the country. And if we go diagonally to the southeast, we've been hearing about Tropical Storm Andrea. And I thought July 1st was the day that the named storms officially started, although that's
no.
Arbitrary.
Yeah, that's kind of arbitrary. It is about a month early. It's usually the first named storm usually occurs, well, on average, on the 9th of July. And so that it occurred here a month before, that's kind of unusual, but not unprecedented. Right now, its center is over North Carolina, but much of the rain from it is occurring well to its north over the D.C. area. And it looks like it's moving along pretty briskly, so it's going to soak the entire kind of Atlantic seaboard.
But we're not talking about like a superstorm Sandy kind of thing.
No, and in fact, in many ways, these kinds of storms bring much more in the way of benefits than problems. They're great rainmakers, and you know, it's part of the climate, and especially in Mexico, it turns out a lot of agriculture wouldn't be possible if there weren't these kind of tropical disturbances providing the rain. So, you know, this is pretty good. And again, yeah, of course, it's nothing like Sandy.
Okay. Well, we touched last week on Eastern Washington. We're talking about rain in the Northeast. And you've been doing some research on Eastern Washington rainfall, and you're discovering the opposite, less rain.
Yeah. Well, the State Climate Office has been looking into the summertime conditions going back to the late 80s, where there's some quite extensive data records. And the one thing we were kind of struck by and surprised by is that the summers there in the Columbia Basin seem to have gotten sunnier. And it's kind of tentative, and we have to make sure that these measurements are correct. They're kind of tricky. But the from the water perspective, that means that there's going to be greater evaporation from the soil and greater transfer of water vapor from the vegetation to the atmosphere, transpiration, and so higher water demands for agriculture.
I see.
And the amount is actually not trivial. It seems like there's about 3 or 4 inches more water that's been required in recent years than there was in the late 80s, early 90s. And, of course, there are competing interests for that water, hydropower and ecological interests and that sort of thing. And so if we don't have abundant winter snowpacks, there can be problems.
Are you looking at this as evidence of climate change?
Well, you know, that always crosses one's mind. Climate change hasn't really reared its ugly head in the Pacific Northwest yet, at least. Our climate models are suggesting that our summers are going to get drier in future decades. And so we're looking into it. I wouldn't attribute it to climate change, but I find it pretty interesting and, again, I'm going to be pursuing it.
Well, Nick, thanks for joining us with a look at all of this, the weather and more. And people can catch you at the Seattle Science Festival, I think, tomorrow?
Yes, that's right. I'm going to, the College and the Environment has some booths there, and I'm going to be at one of them from 4 to 6 p.m. And there's lots of activities and demonstrations. And so I'd really encourage people to show up. And hey, the weather's going to be pretty good.
For science. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, and he's with us every Friday. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And coming up in the next hour on Weekday, our panel of journalists all back. The regulars are here. We're going to be talking about surveillance, Snohomish County executives, Chris Christie, mayors, you name it, we got it here on Weekday.
So many things. Responding today to revelations that the government is tracking our phone calls and online activity, President Obama said, "You can't have 100% security and 100% privacy." The president says we're going to have to make some choices as a society. An update in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
How does a famous American poet tell a joke? All the time.
Why do elephants paint their toenails red? So they can hide in cherry trees.
Andrew Hudgens and his new memoir, The Joker, a personal history of what's made him laugh but hasn't always.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.